Welcome to episode 82 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio. And I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today I'm talking with Jerusha Graham, the museum coordinator for the Robert C. Williams Museum of Papermaking and a working artist. She is based in Atlanta, where she works as a printmaker, papermaker, book artist, and fiber artist, and she exhibits her work nationally and internationally. Graham is a member of the Book Print Artist Scholar of Color, the Movable Book Society, and the North American Hand Papermakers. Graham is interested in creating spaces for socially minded introspection and empathy through her artwork, workshops, and curatorial projects. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Jerusha Graham, welcome to Paper Talk. So great to have you on.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to hearing about your life with paper. And I've known you for a long time, but I didn't realize that much about your body of artwork. So I'm really excited. So tell me about childhood influences. I think you said your parents were artsy and you got an early start.
Well, my mom was had a degree in early childhood education, and my father actually has a degree in art education, but he went into the military. Oh. But we did a lot of art making at home, and because they were interested in the arts, you know, we went to museums and galleries and that kind of thing.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in South Carolina, but grew up on military bases. So I was born in Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and both of my parents are from South Carolina, around the Myrtle Beach area.
Okay.
But I grew up on military bases. We lived in Georgia, North Carolina, Kansas, Germany.
Oh.
And, you know, back to the States. So.
Where in Germany? I'm curious, because I was in Germany.
Stuttgart.
Okay.
And Patch Barracks. Yeah.
Okay.
I was a little girl. Germany was first through third grade for me. So I remember just like, you know, stuff that kids remember, like mostly food related, like Kinder eggs and loving to go to Oktoberfest to get, you know, a lot of food memories. It's growing up on a military basis, like any, you know, small town USA, but
right,
we would,
right,
you know, go make little outings to different places, and holidays we would get to travel. So we got to go to France and tour a lace factory in Holland and got wooden shoes, you know, those kinds of things. But I was, you know, a little girl. So I just assumed that was what everybody did.
Wow, that sounds great. Yeah, my father was a physicist, and he did some research in Karlsruhe one year when I was a junior in high school. So I spent that year. And there was an army base, and we went to church actually there, but I went to the German school.
Yeah, I kind of wish my parents would have sent us to the German school so I'd have a second language. I do have some friends whose parents did that, and now, you know.
Yeah.
I'm hopeless with languages. I want to have a second language, but my brain is like a sieve. Don't hold it.
It's hard. Yeah.
Okay, well, back to paper. So I haven't ever said this to listeners, but I write an outline for all of my interviews. And I was really intrigued by some of the things you told me that you knew at age four, you wanted to be an artist.
I did. I don't remember, but my parents tell me, yeah. I came to them and said, I'm going to be an artist and I need a camera because every great artist takes their own pictures, and I need paints because that's what at the time I understood art, you know, an artist to be. And ironically, like I, the only photography class I ever took, I got kicked out of the dark room and I always overwork my paintings. They end up being mud. So neither one of those things kind of happened, but all throughout my life, it was just understood Jerusha was going to be an artist. So I would get art supplies, birthdays and holidays, and or, you know, the big coffee table, art books, those kinds of things. So always encourage not only my parents, but the larger family, all my aunts and uncles and cousins. Yeah.
Wow, that's really cool. And you mentioned being influenced by several artists and illustrators, and I wondered whether that was in childhood. And one of them, Ezra Jack Keats, I actually looked on my bookshelf last night because I had at least two. I found two of his books, and he did collage for illustration. Yes. And those were my books when I was, you know, little. My mom got them for me. She wrote my name in them.
Yeah, I was greatly influenced by children's book illustrators. So I loved Leo and Diane Dillon, who did a lot of combination of pattern work with figures. Ezra Jack Keats, I did love the collage elements. And then illustrators like Norman Rockwell.
Right.
He was illustrating for Life magazine versus children's books, but I just loved his humor. He could tell a story in a single image, or, you know, sometimes it would be like diptychs or triptychs, but there was just so much information packed into those illustrations. So when I went off to school, I honestly thought I was going to be a children's book illustrator.
And so where did you go to school and how did you discover paper?
I went to the University of Georgia for undergrad, and University of the Arts in Philadelphia for grad school. So I chose University of Georgia because I fell in love with the art building. I originally didn't want to go to a big school. And my father said, at least go do a couple of visits. And I walked in and fell in love with the art building. And then once I was there, I realized, oh, they don't offer children's book illustration here. It's scientific illustration.
Oh.
And a teacher I never took classes with, but would always stop and talk with her because she was one of the few Black professors in the art department, suggested I take a printmaking class. And that changed my life, because in the printmaking class, you know, they really stress the importance of paper. You know, I'm like, I'm paying what? $3 for one sheet of paper? You know, like that was big money to me. But it made such a big difference. The times that I would take and invest in, like, you know, good tools and supplies versus the outcomes I would get when I was trying to be on the cheap. And so it just got me thinking about paper in a different way. And then, unfortunately, I didn't find out about the paper making and book arts class until my final semester of my senior year, or my junior semester of my the second to last semester of my senior year. And so the last semester I took a paper making book arts combo It was a combination class with Rick Johnson.
Oh.
And oh my God, I was beating paper all the time. I got really obsessed with the paper making. And so I kind of spazzed on the book stuff.
Uh-huh.
And Rick was really kind of upset with me because I did not do the book arts portion. They were kind of, you know, quickly slapped together because I spent all my time making paper.
Right.
That I ended up printing on because I was a printmaking major, printmaking and fabric design. So I ended up printing on, you know, all that paper. I think I bound one big book for my thesis.
Okay.
But that did it. I was bitten. And even though I spent all my time focusing on the paper for that last semester, I was curious about the book arts, which is what led me to University Arts in Philadelphia. I specifically was looking for a book arts program.
Okay, I want to ask you a question about at the University of Georgia. Since you were doing printmaking and you realized paper was important, or the surface was important, I'm curious where was papermaking and why didn't you discover it until then? Because this happens a lot with papermaking. It's kind of an obscure thing. And
papermaking was in an old building across campus. Uh-huh. Unless you knew to even go over there, there was no reason for me to be on that side of campus. And right. I don't know why it didn't come up in any of the classes, but
right.
I found out about papermaking because I spent all 4 years in the dorms.
Mm-hmm.
And I was walking by a friend's room and she had a bunch of banana peels hanging like on clotheslines in her room. I was like, what is going on? And she said, oh, I'm taking this papermaking class. And I just wanted to experiment and see what this does if I let these dry out. Uh-huh. And when I heard, I was like, I'm going to check this out. I need to go see what this is about.
Okay.
So it was totally right. by accident.
Right.
And nothing that was communicated through the department, like just being walking around in the dorms and somebody was doing something weird and crazy with materials, you know, testing materials.
So. Right. And it wasn't offered in the printmaking curriculum.
No.
Like, yeah.
I mean, it was, I guess, because Rick, if I'm recalling correctly, Rick was part of the print department, but like I said, it was across campus and it was papermaking and the letterpress.
Mm.
So again, I didn't get to experience any of those things until right at the end. Right. Somehow I managed 4 years in that, or three, because I didn't really encounter the printmaking department until my second year there.
Okay.
I managed 3 years without realizing that that was an option.
Right, right. Interesting. Okay, and then you, did you always know you would go to graduate school?
Yes. Uh-huh. I come from a family of educators. So my grandmother, my mother, several of my aunties, mm-hmm. it was just understood that we were going to do grad school. And mm-hmm. honestly, I still have aunts asking me whether I'm going to get a PhD, you know, like it right. was just understood. Yes. Uh-huh. School education is important and get right. as much of it as you can.
Oh, cool. Okay. So you went to University of the Arts where you did dabble in book arts.
I went specifically for the book arts program.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a combination program. Printmaking and book arts are joined.
Mm-hmm.
And was extremely happy with my choice. Like I can't imagine having done anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So at University of Arts, Winnie Radelyn right. is there. So got to do pulp painting with her because I didn't get pulp painting with Rick because it was an intro
right
combination course that was just wasn't covered. So got to do pulp painting with her, and again, just really enjoyed the papermaking, but also starting to think about manipulating, you know, folding and cutting and thinking about the manipulation of the paper more. Mm-hmm. I had started doing some of that in undergrad. Like I had printed a couple of things that I folded down into envelopes mm-hmm. that you had to interact with. So I just kind of, grad school was an extended exploration of trying to manipulate the material in such a way that it was inviting for people to want to interact with it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, my undergrad exhibition, I took that handmade paper, printed on it, and then I balled all the prints up mm-hmm. and had them flowing out of a suitcase. Uh-huh. And so for people to be able to actually see the artwork, they had to come up and unfold the paper to the images.
I love that.
It didn't work the way I thought it was because people were very hesitant to crumple it back up. Mm. So it was a lot of, like once it was unfolded, it stayed unfolded unless I came back.
And
people were welcome to take them. But again, they were kind of shy about taking it directly from a display. So they'd come and, you know, I want that. I said, if you want it, you have to take it now.
Uh-huh.
I'm not taking orders. If you want it, you know.
Right. And how about the imagery? Like you seem very interested in portraiture and the figure. What has that carried through your work?
That show that I described were all lone figures of Black females mm-hmm. in various poses with a good bit of just blank space of the paper, like letting the paper, you know, the texture and color and crinkle of the paper really inform, like being in conversation with the image.
Mm-hmm.
And I still work figurally, but it's usually a combination of figure and pattern. It's my other undergraduate degree is in fabric design, so thinking about you know how putting together small elements start to create a rhythm and pattern that for me is like visual music. Mm-hmm. Or language, and it also not always directly with specific symbols, but also makes me feel connected to the long history of pattern and textiles around the world, you know, like just continuing to be part of that larger dialogue.
Yeah. Well, and I'm thinking of your paper cuts, which I want to get to, but the way you treat the hair and you do feathers, lots of intricate work and the process also. I think you say it's like a meditation and a prayer. It must be.
It's definitely a meditation. It's, I find that, I enjoy those things that aren't so immediate. Like I like carving, I like cutting. I, you know, like the repetitiveness of stamping a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
It gives me quiet time to reflect. And it also, I calms me.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that calming joy, because it's a joy to make, you know, to create with your hands, gets infused in the work.
Mm-hmm.
And that hopefully the person or the home that it finds itself in, you know, they can feel a little bit of that. you know, I love when I come across things in like the thrift store or old tools, and I feel, you know, I can't fully articulate it, but I feel a connection to the maker.
Yeah, I love that. I have some old papermaking molds, and I definitely think about, wow, who used this 100 years ago, and what was their life like? And my hands are on the same piece of wood that they touched. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know what you mean.
I also think about just that power of making. I also think about it in relation to specifically to African American history, that to be a great craftswoman, a craftsman, could have led to an opportunity to freedom, you know, or an opportunity, even if it didn't lead to freedom, to imbue some of your individuality, your humanity, in the things that you're making. And then if those things got kept and passed on, you know, even though the history is lost, you're still present.
Absolutely. Okay. And that brings me to a question about a piece you saw in a museum and how that influenced some recent work. But I wanted to ask a little about your printmaking, because you're talking about this handwork. What kind of printmaking, and did you do a lot of carving, handwork in the preparation of your prints?
So I'm primarily doing lino cuts or
still
wood blocks.
Doing them. I'm sorry, I said it like it was in the past.
Okay. I mean, I enjoy all of the techniques. I tend not to do quite as much with intaglio, just because I don't like working with acids. Mm-hmm. And sometimes silkscreen, you know, just facilitates kind of a quicker execution of things. But my heart is with the relief. Mm-hmm. And I'd actually like to pivot and start doing some engravings. Most of what I've done has been relief prints. And I actually just finished a set of relief prints for the American Craft Council, their Atlanta Southeast Craft Week. So I can show you one. I'll describe it.
Yeah.
So this is the block here.
Beautiful.
And it's an image of a child asleep on their father's chest. Mm-hmm. In the background is a herringbone or a chevron pattern. It kind of represents the couch that they would be laid out on.
Right.
In this series of cuts, it's titled P.S. I Love You. My father passed last year, and the greatest legacy was just that he was a very loving, outwardly, like showing love all the time. And that was something that many of my cousins, his nieces and nephews, commented on at our service, and then a lot of our family friends as well. Mm-hmm. Just how gentle a man he was. He's a very loving and kind man. So I wanted to make some images that reflected that sense of love and safety. Mm-hmm. And one of my earliest memories is sleeping on my father's chest and hearing his heartbeat.
Oh, I love that. So yeah, your prints and now your paper cuts. How did you get into paper cutting? And maybe tell me, like, I know you're not at the University of the Arts anymore, so how you got back to Atlanta, and if we can kind of weave that through.
When I got out of undergrad, I didn't go straight into grad school.
Okay.
I was working for like JCPenney outlet for a year. And then that same teacher that told me about the printmaking department contacted me and said, there's an apprenticeship program in Philadelphia, the fabric workshop and museum. And so I applied and got opportunity to be an apprentice at the fabric workshop. And there I learned how to do large scale screen prints.
Oh, okay.
But while I was there, I really fell in love with the city and started looking at schools. So I ended up choosing University of the Arts. And then after school, or I should say, while in school, I worked for the African-American Museum in Philadelphia as a docent. Mm-hmm. And after I got out of school, I really didn't have a big plan. You know, I was like, I just was so focused on grad school. I didn't make the what happens after plans. I went to a job fair at the school, but there was very few arts booths at the job fair, which was interesting since it was University of the Arts. But one of them was a puppet theater that specialized in large scale street puppets for parades. And I ended up getting that job and working with Spiral Cube Puppet Theater, which was a nonprofit arts and activism.
What's it called? Spiral Cube?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Spiral Cube Puppet Theater. Hmm. So I've worked with them for 3 years. I started off as a teaching artist. And then because of my museum experience, when the museum coordinator left, they asked that I managed the very small museum of puppets, because I also had some experience teaching, coming from a family of teachers. Like I, you know, knew how to make a lesson plan and break it down for different age groups and that kind of thing. I eventually ended up becoming the education coordinator and the museum coordinator. It was a small nonprofit, you know, staff. Yeah. Five at the most, you know. But I, working there really, again, expanded my appreciation for paper, because everything that we built was built from cardboard and macheed. And I had been so focused on more of the two-dimensional, or a more kind of confined three-dimension with the book, but scaling for puppets that require three people to work together to operate, or figuring out on the fly someone who says, I want to be a giraffe in the parade, and you've got to figure out, okay, what's the structure? How do I build this and make sure that it's stable? I just gained a greater appreciation for thinking about paper in the third dimension. Mm-hmm. I'll be the first one to tell you, though, you know, I'm not a natural sculptor. I'm definitely, I think, in terms of printmaking, two-dimensional and in layers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it was a good experience, and it really enhanced my understanding of the power of art as a tool for activism. Mm-hmm. Because we're going into communities and saying, we're a tool for you. What is important for you, for this community to express, and facilitating conversation and brainstorming to then whittle it down to visual elements that could be built in paper.
So this is what Spiral Q did, went into communities, and then they would create performances about...
A lot of sometimes performances, mostly parades. So parades. Like maybe a community wants to celebrate someone within the community, you know, that mother, that grandmother that kind of keeps an eye out for everyone, that is under, you know, doesn't get the appreciation and acknowledgement, or tough issues like affordable housing. If you're out on the street trying to pass out flyers or get people to come to a conversation about affordable housing, you're not going to get the same reaction that you get when you actually dress adults in house-shaped outfits and you're stomping down the street. People will actually come to you and ask, what's going on? What is this for? And get that information. And a lot of the time, we had more puppets than we had people. So we'd start off early in the day laying out the puppets on the street, and people would come by and ask. And we'd say, well, there'll be a parade, a street parade at whatever time, if you want to come back and be part of it. And people would go home and put their groceries up and tell their neighbors and come back with a group of people. So it's a great way to engage important topics, you know.
Right.
Without people putting up their defenses.
Yeah, yeah, that's really cool. Okay, so then what happened next?
Well, even though it's puppets and it can be a lot of fun, it was nonprofit and a small staff. So at a certain point, I was working 16-hour days, 6 days a week, and I just got burned out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was like, this is important. It's important work. It really is. But I just cannot keep that kind of schedule. And I had been talking with my family. I have a brother who's 18 years younger than me. And just feeling like I was, you know, missing a lot of the formative years, that if we had some shared memories, you know, would strengthen our relationship. And debating whether I was just going to find another job in Philly or move home to be closer to family. And again, this that family support. My father said, well, just come home and make your artwork. Just come home and make your work. And so I moved back home and just focused on making a body of work that I could, you know, apply to grants and pitch for exhibitions and those kinds of things. You know, although it was a bit of a shock to move back to Georgia and realize that the kinds of resources that were available in Pennsylvania for the arts was not like that framework was really not present in Georgia. We just don't fund the arts in the same way, like formal funding of the arts.
Right.
And so I ended up substitute teaching for a while and looking for like, how am I going to continue to make artwork? And discovered the Atlanta Printmaker Studio. I, you know, became a member and started making work at Atlanta Printmaker Studio. And that connection, like I would volunteer to help with outreach because it was, the outreach was very much like the kinds of things that I had been doing with Spiral Q in terms of engaging communities that maybe don't have as much access to arts and resources. And because I was substitute teaching, I had a flexible schedule.
Right.
So I was doing a lot of the outreach, and they eventually offered me the outreach coordinator position at Atlanta Printmaker Studio.
Okay.
And so I coordinated, you know, workshops and those kinds of things, and while at the same time still making artwork and looking for places for the work to show. I had an exhibition, actually the building that Atlanta Printmaker Studio was in had a small gallery that belonged to the guy that we sublet it from. And I had an exhibition of actually paper cuts in that space. And one of the other members of Atlanta Printmaker Studio saw the work, and it was a member I did not know. And I got contacted via email saying, hi, I was at Atlanta Printmaker Studio, saw your work. And I work at Art Institute and think you would be great for teaching art foundations. Would you be interested in coming in for an interview?
Wow.
So I ended up teaching for Art Institute of Atlanta. And from there, other teaching opportunities arose. I taught at Kennesaw State and University of West Georgia and was kind of juggling all of those as an adjunct professor while still doing part-time the outreach coordination for Atlanta Printmaker Studio. So it was, you know, like four or five jobs just kind of juggling off kind of part-time, you know, adjunct professors, you get a couple of classes, but it's not enough. Like you have to be doing something else as well.
Yeah. And you don't get benefits and yeah, there's a lot of,
yeah. So, get that. You know, I was teaching foundations for Art Institute, but at Kennesaw, I got to teach their papermaking and book arts program. And I taught foundations for West Georgia. So, I mean, I enjoy teaching. I don't enjoy grading.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then I was also teaching on Saturday's high school program for one of the art centers.
Wow. And you found time to make your own work still too?
Yes. And I have to say that I work very slowly, so I'm not making large amounts of work. But when I moved back home, my goal was, okay, I need to make sure that I participate in at least 3 shows a year, you know, and group shows, you don't have to have 30 pieces for a group show.
Right.
So as long as I'm trying to work steady, I'll have a few pieces that I can, you know, put in shows. Obviously, I'm making my, at that time, making my living teaching.
Right.
So that I can like make the things that I want to make at the glacial pace that I work. And I do work very slowly. Like, I've tried to speed up, but I talk slow. I eat slow. I walk slow. I'm just a slow, I exist in the world as a slow moving turtle, I guess.
That's okay. That's everybody's different.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to tell you about The Paper Advisor, a place where you can discover my most popular papermaking and papercraft resources, including information about tools and supplies, how-to videos, and paper tips, all in one place. You can ask The Paper Advisor your paper questions there, too. And best of all, it's free. Find The Paper Advisor by going to HelenHebertStudio.com and looking for the free Paper Advisor link in the upper right-hand corner. Now back to the episode.
I want to know how you got into paper cutting. Was that in graduate school or later?
No.
Or did it relate to printmaking at all?
The paper cutting, actually, I was out of grad school and teaching, working at Sparrow Cue Puppet Theater. And I have a love-hate relationship with time. Like I'm always running late. And it had been a morning where I was like half a block away when the bus pulled off that I needed for work. And I was just like kicking myself. Like I really need to be, you know, get there on time. And why did this happen? And a professor from University of the Arts, again, that I never took classes with, but that lived, or that not lived, but he had a gallery on the street that I lived on, was driving by and he offered me a ride. And so I took the ride. And because he had picked me up, I don't think he had been had me in mind, but we were talking and he said, you know, I'm on an advisory board for a new residency program, or, you know, artist in residence program. And this first year, we're not doing like open calls. It's just recommendations from the advisory board. Would you like me to put your name forth? And yes, please. And it was a free studio space for a year.
Oh, wow.
40th Street. Artists in residence.
Uh-huh.
And so during my time in the residency, I was like, well, what am I going to work on? I didn't at that time have a specific body that I had been working on. And I don't know what it was that triggered it, but I started thinking about the Ezra Keats Snowy Day book. It's this little black boy in a red snowsuit, full body snowsuit out in the white snow. And I cut some little figures and use like brown craft paper for the faces,
mm-hmm.
and just white copy paper for the little snowsuits, and did, I don't know, maybe 6 or 8 little kids. I might have one that I could show you.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed the process. It wasn't fine art. Like, it wasn't something that I would show in, you know, put forth to show in a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
But just the cutting of the cutting and pasting of the paper, I said, oh, I want to do that again. Like, I love that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked the idea, but I didn't know what I was going to do with it. And I keep sketchbooks some years better than others.
Mm-hmm.
But I had done a couple of sketches of, again, most of my figures are female just because that's the perspective that I'm working from.
Right.
And I did these sketches during the residency. I did a couple of kind of, you know, 8x10 cuts. Honestly, the residency, if you looked at the work that was produced, it wasn't great work. But just to have the space, like a place to go and
right.
Try to wrap my head around stuff was nice. And I was, you know, it was a great experience. And I did that and went on to just, you know, continuing the work with Spiral Q. When I moved back home, I was flipping through my sketchbooks and I saw some of these little sketches that I made during that residency and thought, I think, you know, I still like that idea of paper cuts. And so I figured, let me try to do these on a larger scale.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these are a little bit more serious than the little kids in snowsuits. And I did the first cut and was pretty pleased with it. I like that it requires... Doing a paper cut requires you to simplify,
mm-hmm.
you know, even though like you were talking, I like to do pattern work. I ended up editing out a lot of details that I would include if I was working in another way.
Right.
Even if I was carving, I'd probably have a lot more lines to express the curves and those kinds of things. But with paper cut, I'm usually trying to figure out how can I express that curve or that sense of weight,
mm-hmm.
you know, posture, gesture,
mm-hmm.
with one cut versus mm-hmm. 15 or 20, right. you know?
Yeah.
So I like that it, again, quieted. I feel like the cutting calms me and gives me focus, but the actual pieces themselves create a quiet space. A bubble that allows you to just like have some time with them.
Yeah. And I noticed you, you name your series and you mentioned the name of the one about your father had the word love in it, but I forgot already.
It's P.S. I love you.
Yes. I love you. Right. So how did you start? It seems like that's the way you work. Is it like exhibition driven now, or just like how do you come up with?
It's not exhibition driven. It just helps me focus. Mm-hmm. If I think sometimes it's a title or mm-hmm. a song or a mm-hmm. quote or phrase that inspires the first image.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like I get so much more out of it when I allow myself to explore various iterations of that concept versus right. just doing a one-off. And it may be small additions, like our small series. So it might be 6,
mm-hmm.
you know, or like with the lino cuts, I did 10 of these. With the paper cuts, like I think the first set, I did 5 or 6, and then the next iteration was a year or maybe 2 years later. So they had a different title, but they were informed by the previous series. So my first cuts.
What was the title of that first series?
The first series was titled Waiting. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it was a series of kind of lone women that were in an in-between stage, because I was in an in-between stage. I was like done with school.
Right.
And working, but like, what was like, where was I going to go from there? Like, I'm working at this place, but where's my art going? Mm-hmm. And so the figures are women that, as for the viewer, I hope that you feel like you've either just missed the main action, mm-hmm. or it's just about to happen. You're waiting for that next big thing to happen. So the first one I cut was a woman with very short hair, Black woman with very short hair, with her hands on her chin, kind of mm-hmm. resting her head in her hands, and her elbows rested on a counter or a table or something, mm-hmm. and she's mm-hmm. looking off to her left. And then another one in that series, we just get the back of her, mm-hmm. and she also has her elbows up on the counter, kind of like she's leaning back.
Right.
And so we're getting to see kind of the muscles in her back, because she's got a summer dress on, and then the pattern of her kind of a geometric floral pattern on her dress and braids in her hair. So those were the first paper cuts that I did that were based on the sketches that I had done at the 40th Street Artist in Residence. And then I did a small series of little tiny cuts for it was a student-led magazine at University of Georgia. They had contacted me as an alumni to mm-hmm. see if I would provide work for the theme. And the theme was Exodus. So I did a series of figures cut out of black, and then with certain elements highlighted with white paper mm-hmm. pasted behind, and then mounted those on craft paper. I love the like look of a brown craft paper. And those were focused on with waiting, you're kind of waiting for that next moment, that in-between stage. And I mm-hmm. felt like with the Exodus figures, they're also in an in-between stage. You know, you have you no longer have a country. You're
right.
Refugee, mm-hmm. Carrying all that you own or have in the world, carrying that on your body and trying to identify, the essence of like who you are, how are you defining yourself? You know, if your main definition was your job and now you no longer have that job, how do you define yourself in the world? Or if your main definition of yourself was your country or mm-hmm. country of origin, mm-hmm. and for whatever reason you're having to say goodbye to that, again, how are you defining yourself? So I just feel like there, from each exploration, I'm taking a little bit and finding a different, just turning it just a little bit to find a different angle.
Yeah. And the images are so graphic, and you really, like you said, you have to kind of, and on your website, you say you seek to whittle the essence of the image down to intimate poetic observations about humanity. And it really comes through, and listeners will, I'll post some images. Okay. So we're talking a lot. I want to get to the story about, you saw, this piece at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Mm-hmm. And I think that led to a recent series. Is that right?
Recent. So in, I think it was 2018, I went to Philadelphia for the, College Book Arts Association mm-hmm. conference, and on the way back home, stopped in Washington to see the National African American Museum of Culture and Heritage. I think I got all the letters. It's a long.
I wrote it down. Title. I think it's History and Culture. Yeah.
Oh, History and Culture. Oh my goodness, there was just so much stuff. I didn't get through the entire thing because I was stopping and reading every little bit. But one of the things that stopped me in my tracks was this cotton bag, you know, for harvesting cotton sack.
Right.
And on it is embroidered a story, basically a child, you know, was sold off, and her mother gave her the cotton sack, and it had a handful of pecans. She said, gave it to her in a, and I think a dress. Mm-hmm. In, you know, in this sack is a dress, handful of pecans, and my love.
Right.
And that thing just floored me, and it's still just ricocheting in my head. I wasn't sure what to do with it then, and I still am not entirely certain, but it hits me every time I think about it. And then
so it was a slave who had to give her daughter away, and she gave her this sack.
And she gave her that sack, and the embroidery on it that relays the story is the granddaughter of the child that was sent away.
Right. You know? So it was held on through the generations.
Yeah.
And the story was told, and the granddaughter and then wanted to preserve it on the sack. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm having so much trouble actually describing it. And then, when I was talking about that sack kind of inspiring the my most recent show, Freedom Isn't Free, the journalist that was interviewing me told me, hey, did you know there's actually been a book written about the sack, the Ashley sack, called The Thing She Carried.
Right. By Tia Miles. I'll put a link to that too. So it's the whole story. And
yes.
Yeah.
Or what she can piece together.
Yes, exactly. Kind of,
you know, a lot of it is that they'll never know, but, you know, talking about what the possibilities are, Tia's allowed to kind of inform the reader about common practices and other historical elements. So
right.
It's an interesting read, but that sack, I tell you, it's still resonating with me. So for that exhibition, it was kind of a combination. So I stitched some banners, some textile banners, and I've been thinking a lot about mending stitches.
Mm-hmm.
And so I created these banners using or decorating them with mending stitches that said life, liberty, happiness, and people. This was the other, for that show. But I also combined it with works throughout the years. So I had some of my paper cuts that I paired the textiles with, and a few of my prints. I had one titled Blood, Sweat, and Tears, which I don't know that I can get it far enough back.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I see it.
It's
a flag and a person behind it, like behind bars in a way. You have a reference. Yes,
a flag, American flag oriented vertically in red. And then the figure is a lino cut block printed in blue of a man with an afro and a heart on his chest. Mm-hmm. But the flag itself was created using paper cut. So I made a collage of the flag and did a pressure print on the letterpress.
Okay.
So the different heights of the paper create, you know, if you've got an area that's built up a lot, it's going to print darker because when you roll it through the press, it's getting more pressure and being able to collect more ink. So there's
always a texture.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So there's always that, you know, even in the print, there's that relationship with paper coming through.
Now your paper cuts are primarily commercial paper. Is that right? I think you mentioned handmade paper is harder to cut. Do you sometimes
not
do
all
layers?
Handmade paper, right. But I made a piece using indigo paper from Cave Papers, and that was really tough stuff. And I can show you that one, and maybe that can get included on the. So this piece is titled "Like a Living River," and it is a female figure with her hand on her hip, but you're only seeing her from her mouth down to about her knee. So you're looking at her torso, and it's cut out of the indigo paper. So it's a deep, dark, rich, lovely blue, and it's got some, you know, the texture of the paper. And then in that silhouette, I cut what looks like teardrops or blood shaped drops that cover her stomach, with the exception of a little circle at the center that houses a cowrie shell that I stitched to the paper, kind of sits where her belly button would sit. And then on her breast is some chain stitching in red thread. And then underneath all of that is a what looks like a family, a man, a woman, and a little baby, who I think of kind of wading through this river. And this is just maybe, or not maybe, but it really was me personally thinking about just the power of the female body to bring life into the world, you know, as a vessel.
Yeah.
As a vessel for life.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Wow. So how do you compose your paper cuts? Are you sketching them and then cutting? Are you just cutting? I saw a video, and I'll post a link of you. I think you sketch, but describe the process a little bit.
So I do a lot of kind of smaller sketches, you know, just to work out, you know, general composition. And then I sketch to scale, and I'm usually using a full sheet. Right now, I've been working through a pack of a Canson, black Canson paper that was gifted to me, and, you know, free supplies, I'm gonna use them.
Yeah. Are they so like 19 by 25, a little bigger?
A little bigger.
Okay.
What's the next
maybe 22 by 30? I don't know.
Yes,
commercial
yes,
papers.
22 yeah. by 30.
Okay.
Yeah. So I sketched them out to that scale, but on tracing paper.
Okay.
Because even though I've done little sketches, things always change when I scale up. And so it may take a couple of sketches before I get what I want. And so I can overlay the sketches. I like how the head and shoulders came out here, but I like the hand from that sketch. And so I overlay and kind of trace, make a clean tracing of the elements that I like, put all together. And then I transfer that final sketch to the back side of my paper using white carbon paper.
Okay.
And so that's my guide for cutting. I cut from the back so I can see my my carbon marks. But I also leave myself the freedom to edit and adjust when I'm cutting as well. So it may not be an exact, like if you looked at what was sketched and then
right,
there'll be some variations.
Sure. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then once that's cut, I mount it on sometimes just another sheet of paper, white paper. Sometimes I'll mount it on like art board, you know, something that's a little thicker, a little more, you know, it's got a little more stiffness and body to it. And the earlier pieces I would spray mount, but I've been using art tack. So it basically makes your sheet like a big sticker. Okay. So I can put the art tack on the back of the paper in cut through the art tack, but I find that it slows my cutting down to have the thickness of the art tack.
Sure. But you back. Have to put the art tack first, otherwise it would go through all the holes, right?
Actually, no.
No.
So that you can, the art tack, when you put your paper down, you burnish it a little bit. Oh, okay. So I usually put a piece, you know, to protect the image.
Yeah.
And when you lift up, it only lifts the dots of adhesive where the paper.
Okay, this is a great recommendation. I'm adding this to your recommendations. Does it come on a roll? Or how does it? In
it
sheets.
Comes as sheets.
Oh, okay.
Where is my?
That's all right. We'll correspond about it later.
Yeah.
But I've used different rolls, but
I wish it came.
Doesn't break away like you're talking from.
I wish it came as a roll because I find it, you know, the sheets I get are not big sheets, so I end up having to do it in sections too. And then once you've picked up the adhesive dots, when you go to mount, it's repositionable until you apply pressure.
Okay. Oh. And are your cuts one sheet of paper? It sounds like that. Or do you sometimes have multiple sheets?
Up until recently, they've been one sheet of paper. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I had two shows this year, and one at Spalding Nick's Gallery and one at Callenwald Art Center. So the Freedom Isn't Free exhibition at Callenwald, those pieces were, you know, full sheets.
Mm-hmm.
But the pieces for Spalding Nick's were smaller pieces that were arranged more, you know, more like a traditional collage where I cut sections. I like, out of the two ways of working, I like cutting the entire sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Because I also, when I cut two pieces facing one another. I'll have the drawing on the back of one and I'll cut through both layers. So I end up with editions of two, but they're
mirror image.
And when I cut and I have a lot of pieces, the first edition or the, you know, first one in the edition is going to be slightly different than the second. Like it's hard to get them to be positioned exactly in the same place.
Okay.
Yeah, I prefer doing.
Now, I can't remember where I was looking. It seems like the Callenwald show you can no longer look at, but do you sell your work through a gallery? Like I remember seeing prices somewhere and your work is gorgeous. I think people might be interested. So I just wanted to ask that.
Right now I'm not represented by a gallery. You know, usually when the work is, up on exhibit,
okay,
you know, whoever is, housing the exhibition,
right.
Manages the,
so I must've looked when it was on exhibit. Okay. I just wanted to know. And you have a couple of shows.
All the Knicks may still have it listed. I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. And you're working on a couple of shows that are coming up, I believe.
I have two shows in 2022 that I've got to like get to work on pronto. Mm-hmm. The most recent focus. So I had the shows this year, and then have just been focusing on North American Hand Paper Makers. I've just cycled out as the VP of exhibitions,
right,
and was just trying to get things in place for the next person coming in.
Right.
So now it's time to buckle down for those other two shows. And the gallery spaces are fairly large.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly really don't want to do another kind of compilation show. So it'll be a grind.
New work. A lot of new work.
Yes.
Are you going to do paper cuts, more stitching? Have you planned?
I definitely want to do more stitching. Mm-hmm. And it seems a shame to me that I love paper making. Like, I really enjoy that, but I haven't really incorporated into the last few exhibitions that I've done.
Mm-hmm.
So I right now plan on having some elements of my paper making, which I haven't been doing as much of.
And where do you make paper? We haven't talked about the museum where you work. Is that where you make paper, or do you have your own paper making set up?
No, I work in communal spaces. So okay. Like my home studio, uh-huh, is a very tiny room that looks like it's exploding. So when I want to do prints, I may carve and take those to Atlanta Printmaker Studio. Mm-hmm. If I'm doing paper, I may stay late. I didn't mention it, but I work for the Robert C. Williams Museum of Papermaking. So right. I may stay late and, you know, produce work in the space, or I may bring a few molds home and make paper out in the yard.
Okay. Yeah.
Usually where I'm doing that.
Uh-huh.
So I don't have any like fancy setup. I'm using the spaces that I'm connected to.
Yeah. Well, that's a great way. That's a great way to work. Yeah. And we'll talk another time about your job there, because you do so much. Do you work full time in addition to making this work?
Yes. Uh-huh. I work full time.
Yeah. Busy.
The museum coordinator. So installing exhibitions is my primary responsibility, and making all the paper pulp for workshops. So the paper museum, we have a lovely space.
Yeah.
But it's a small staff. It's three people.
Right.
So wearing a lot of different hats.
Right. And how many exhibitions, how often do they change?
We do about three a year. Sometimes we'll do four, but it's mm-hmm. kind of with the semester changes and then the mm-hmm. summer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this museum is at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Is that right? I got that right. Yeah. Well, we need to talk more about that at some other time, but I want to get to your recommendations. And so you wanted to recommend the podcast, which I listen to.
Oh, wonderful.
Cut the Craft. So just describe that a little bit, and we'll put it in the show notes.
Cut the Craft is produced by Brian Beidler and Amy Umble. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And they've just talk to craftspeople about their practice, their mm-hmm. philosophies. And I love hearing about what other people are doing in their studio and how they, you know, got involved in the things that they do.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And they talk to woodworkers, weavers, paper makers, all kinds of people. Yeah, yeah, it's really neat. Okay. And then the exhibition tour, Women to Watch 2020, Paper Roots.
Yeah. So just inspiration. I was blessed with being one of the women to watch in Georgia. It's an exhibition that was put on by the National Museum of Women in the Arts.
Mm-hmm.
But every year they choose a different medium to focus on. And last year the focus was paper. And just like, if you go to their website,
yeah, and, I'll put the link.
There's a great tour of the national exhibition. Just so such inspiring work, and just the conceptually what people, how people are approaching paper. I'm also inspired by the women that were in the exhibition for the Georgia committee. And I think I gave you a link to the videos of them talking about their process.
Yes. And there's one of you too, which I'll put in the show notes for sure. Yeah.
And then there's one that's not on here that I need to highlight, is the Book Print Artist Scholar Collective, which is BIPOC group of what it says, artists and scholars that are focused on book arts, paper making, print making, or you know, print media history, those kinds of things. And I find so much inspiration looking at the Instagram feed of the other members.
Oh.
I'm a member of that.
Uh-huh.
It's just exciting to see what people are doing in their studios, and also how they're using paper making and book arts and printmaking to extend the conversations about race and social justice in our society. Not all of the works are focused on that, but I think it's an important aspect.
Right. So do you know what it would be on Instagram? How we would find it?
Yes.
Book Print Artist Scholar Collection?
It's listed as Book Print Collective. So you'll find it at Book Print Collective.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And I'll put that in the show notes too, but some people are just listening and they can just look it right up. So yay. All right, Jerusha. And you have a website, which I'll put in the show notes, but it's Jerusha Graham.
JERUSHIA.
GRAHAM.wixsite.com.
Yes.
And then you're on Facebook and Instagram. Anywhere else we can find
you? That's about it.
All right. Well, it's been lovely talking to you and learning about your work. And thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can find out more at helenhebertstudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season, the make and take.